That's Grammy Award winning multi-instrumentalist Yusuf Lateef with Back Home. And of course you heard his signature blend of jazz and Eastern music. Though he was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, he is a son of Detroit. It's where he developed his chops and was in the company of many jazz giants. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Wednesday, October the 30th, and our focus today is on the cash-strapped city of Detroit. There's a fierce legal battle going on, and if the battle is won by the city or the state, it's going to be rough. It will be the largest bankruptcy in the history of the United States. But more than that, it will begin a domino effect, and I'm predicting that if it does go through, if the federal court, the federal bankruptcy court, does give the green light for the city of Detroit to declare bankruptcy, the domino effect will be that many cities that are teetering on the brink, or many cities that might eventually be teetering on the brink, will be brought even faster to the brink and will be systematically emptied of its, of their current populations, and then reinvented in the image of interests who want a, quote, different America, unquote. Well, we are awaiting our guest, and while we are, our guest is hung up in court, we understand. So we'll wait for that to happen, but we still have our next guest. We can probably begin to connect with that next guest very shortly. The focus is on Washington, D.C., and of course, we have this kind of, I don't know what to call it. You know, it's not really anybody looking for solutions. Everybody is maintaining the same positions. The Democrats are very pro-Obamacare. The Republicans are very critical of Obamacare. And the person who is representing the administration, Kathleen Sebelius, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, well, Kathleen Sebelius is there to explain and give no particular concrete answers to any questions. As far as I could see, I'm listening. They all are maintaining their same positions. She's maintaining, well, I can't give you any answers to anything specific until mid-November. Well, could you tell us whether, if the president said that if you like your if you like your policy, you will be able to hold on to your policy. If you like your current position, you'd be able to hold on to your current position. If that is not happening, I mean, that is guaranteed to happen. She says, well, we have no way of guaranteeing any of that. So it's the same position. The thing that we ought to keep in mind here is that nobody is asking the fundamental question. They're not even going back to the constitutionality of the law, the so-called law. I guess they will fight that at some point in time. And the deal now is at least slow momentum before this bill is forced upon, actually forced and enforced by the IRS, which will be empowered to place sanctions on people and levy fines against them for not having a coverage of some sort. But every day it's a whole new revelation about something else. We talked yesterday about the fact that you know, people were raising questions about the contract for this boondoggle. Was a no-bid contract and millions of dollars, and it's ridiculous. We'll get to that, but let's talk about Detroit today, because it's really a very, very important story. It's an all-out battle in the federal bankruptcy court, and as I said, it could set in motion an extreme form of urban warfare. It's a systematic, forcible emptying of a city, and it is not to be lost on anybody that this is a black city, really. The heart of Detroit is predominantly African American and Latino. The governor had appointed an emergency city manager to oversee the city, which was in financial ruins by the time this most recent mayor, Mayor Dave Bing, was elected. In fact, he asked the governor for help, and the governor appointed an attorney who once was with the Justice Department overseeing insurance and bankruptcies to oversee the city's emergency plan. And we have the governor basically appointing the city manager to bring the city on. Well, under some kind of a plan, and this involved working with the unions and their pension plans and cutting costs or whatever it is, but to come up with a plan. There was great acrimony, and there continues to be great acrimony between the unions representing city workers, pensioners, even the small business community. By the way, just to give you an idea, Detroit's population is now more less than half of what it was a mere couple of decades ago. It systematically has been losing population. And the population that remains is vastly underserved, in really poor shape in terms of city services like education, schools, hospitals, police, ambulances, and the like, rescue and the like. So this has been going on for some time. The long shot, upshot of the story is that the case is now before a federal bankruptcy judge, and the judge has to determine whether there has been a sincere effort to work out some kind of a mutually agreeable plan all the way around. And if he finds that the city's plan is credible, and he has evidence that everybody's on board with it, we'd give it a go. And that will begin the domino effect, because that is where the fear comes in. Is our guest on the line? Okay, we're trying to locate our guest.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Great. So, we had gotten an overview about the recent history of Detroit from Professor Thomas Sugrue, if you remember, on August the 20th. He was with us and gave us a very comprehensive view. And I thought it would be a great idea to hear from ground level what the interpretation of events would be. And nobody could do this better than our guest, and I'm delighted that she is with us. Her name is Elena Herrada, and she was, as she said, born into activism, and she joins us from the great city of Detroit. Elena, good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Actually, I have to correct you when you say that nobody could give the better overview. There's actually quite a few of us in the trenches.
And there I'll tolerate your modesty for a while here. Before we go into the details of it, tell me a bit about your family's background. Your father was a longtime activist. It's probably a genetic trait in your family.
Well, you know, my family are kind of like the average Detroit people in regards to activism. My father was a UAW member. He worked at Chrysler. And my grandfather was a UAW member. He worked at Ford Rouge. And my dad was strike captain of his local for about 43 years. Chrysler was the only of the big three that allowed white-collar workers in the union. So my uncles, when they moved up to become engineers at Ford, were in management, but my father was always needed the union. So he wouldn't leave Chrysler. So he ended up as an engineer, white-collar worker at Chrysler for many years as a member of UAW Local 412. And we grew up with a very, very clear sense that without the union we would have been much less, that there were all kinds of industries that were very wealthy industries that brought people here to work, but without the union there would have never been an equitable share for workers. And we grew up on Blue Cross and two cars, and we lived a good life in a way that only Detroit really realized. And I contend, and many of us contend, that that's the reason that we're under attack, is because Detroit was the great experiment of working class people who came from nothing to be able to live good lives. And there's always been a tremendous amount of resentment around working class people being able to have vacations and, you know, own homes. We had the highest, number of home ownership of African Americans in the entire country. It's been a very, very livable place. And so that's the context from which we come. Everyone came here to work, and everyone here worked hard, and no one here came to serve anyone. So that's what we do. And to have someone come in and appoint an emergency manager when we knew, first of all, we repealed the law.
Well, hold on. We're going to get there.
Okay.
We're
going
to get there. I just want to mention, and then we move on, that you are an elected member of the school board.
I am. I'm elected to the Detroit School Board. There's 11 members, 7 district, 4 are at large.
And we will talk about education in a minute, because I want to talk about education in Detroit having much in common with education in many large urban centers and not too far from you, akin to what's going on in Chicago, New York City, Philadelphia, and so forth.
Right.
Now, take us into what is the city's feeling? What are you getting at ground level about people's feeling as to where Detroit is right now? How are you interpreting when Detroit is right now?
Detroit is in a state of, I guess, somewhere between depression and rage. We're watching the bankruptcy hearings. Our mayor, Kilpatrick, went to prison for 28 years for a number of charges, not the least of which was perjury. And we're watching the governor lie on the stand day after day after day about how he came to bring Jones Day to Detroit. So there's a tremendous amount of resentment. There's all kinds of reactions. Some people are throwing in with the crooks because that's, you know, the shortest line to being able to, you know, just get some money and take care of things. And many people feel like it's way too powerful to fight. And then there's other people that are just so angry that they'll do nothing but fight.
Right now, the city of Detroit is really operating on very, very bare bones. Tell us what the configuration is. What is the political configuration of the city of Detroit right now?
Well, all of the local offices in Detroit, meaning city council and school board, those are the two elected offices in Detroit, have been stripped of power and taken over by emergency financial managers. When we voted out financial managers, we got emergency managers. It's important to note that they put us in exponentially greater debt than we had been. They've spent the money just like it's been a spending orgy with absolutely no transparency. For example, on the school board, we had, you know, a huge district that's now been broken into 3 districts. One is a failing district with no oversight, so they took our students, they took our newly built buildings, leased them to the Educational Achievement Authority for $1, and took our most vulnerable students, those who have, like, there's no way to get them into another school somewhere else. There's nobody to do that for them. And they pushed them into the Educational Achievement Authority. That's 15 schools. They then took our dual schools, the most successful and those with the most resources and put them into what's called a self-governing district. They took 9 of those and put private oversight over those. And then the remaining schools are with us, with the school board, and we have absolutely no power over the curriculum, no power over hiring or firing. They've essentially broken the unions, although there's still some semblance of union contracts. So they cut back teachers' wages. There's upwards of 50 students in most of our classrooms. And there's a narrative in the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press and on the TV channels 2, 4, and 7 that the emergency manager has really turned around education in Detroit, and it's in much better shape.
Wow. From your vantage point, Elena, how did Detroit end up where it is today?
Well, the last 10 years or so has been really important, because the most important loss of revenue that we have faced was due to the loss of the residency requirement for jobs. So if you lived in Detroit and if you worked in Detroit, you had to live in Detroit, and that was our tax base. And during the Archer Engler administration, we lost the residency requirement, and Coleman Young used to refer to the police department as an occupation army of white police officers over a black city, and that was the most important tenet of having residency, is that you live where you work, and that was also how we were able to pay our bills. That's how we were able to afford trash pickup and lights and everything else that we needed. So when we lost residency, the state agreed to pay a revenue share for what we lost, and that would be the revenues brought in by the lighting and the water departments particularly. The state reneged on its deal and never paid one penny in revenue sharing. So there's millions of dollars owed to Detroit in revenue sharing that the state has refused to pay. We call that the Dred Scott provision. So since the state refused to pay, we started to go broke. The deal.
Just want to ask you, though, why do you call it the Dred Scott provision?
Because the state refuses to pay Detroit because Detroit is black. And they've basically said there is no debt that they are bound to pay. Mm. So we refer to that as Dred Scott. And we also refer to the incoming white emergency mayor who's stealing this election as our ability to get paid the money that the state owes, because there's going to be a white mayor. There's deep, deep resentment and suspicion around the upcoming elections. So Jones Day takes over. Today in the paper, we see that they're selling off the water department. This could only happen if there is no government in place in Detroit. So it was essential that the governor remove Detroit's governing body in order to be able to suspend our charter, so we have no home rule. So this is exactly as if we were a little colony that got taken over. All of our assets are being sold off, and our own people have absolutely nothing to say about it, but we have to pay the taxes.
Well, you know, this is interesting that you're saying this, Elena, because from the outside looking in, it looks like Detroit is a victim of its own failed leadership. It looks like Detroit was plundered. It was a case of black folks having a shot of power but unable to manage themselves and govern themselves, electing a bum and a thief for mayor, and look what he did. And now you have another mayor who came in behind him who is useless. And so the city, in a way, could not avoid crashing and burning.
That's exactly the narrative. Imagine that day after day after day for 30 years. That is
now,
the newspaper
you're telling
narrative.
Us there's a different narrative.
I'm telling you that is a bold-faced lie. That is a bold-faced lie about Detroit.
And so the real narrative
Kilpatrick
is
wasn't
what?
The sharpest knife in the drawer, and he didn't have any politics, but he couldn't begin to have done the things that he's been accused of. He's serving 28 years in federal prison, and it's like the press around it is like the O.J. trial. It's like a lynch mob around him. He was, you know, there's not much redeemable about him, but he couldn't have done in his entire career what Jones Day does in a day here. It's a complete distraction. And the way race works It was really easy to do that. It was just really easy to create a demon out of pretty much somebody who was hapless. I mean,
what was the tipping point?
Yeah,
what was the tipping point between the time when you
created,
said
though,
that you
the
said
text
that people,
message scandal
oh, sorry.
Was 2 years old when they brought that.
I'm sorry, Elena, I missed that. We were overlapping because there's a slight lag on our phones. Don't worry about it. So just repeat what you were just
saying. The text message scandal that was what was created to bring down the mayor was a two-year-old batch of messages, 2 years old. But they did come at the most important time of the history of this country, and that was during the Obama election. The actual timing of them was 2 years before that, and nobody in Detroit would have cared about that. People could care less about who sleeps with who. And that, I mean, that's like Detroit is an extremely, extremely tolerant city when it comes to, people's personal debauchery.
What about the charges of racketeering and extortion and fraud?
Right, those are charges that should be brought against Snyder and Kevin Orr right now. And the entire crew that's taken over our city, those charges are not even thought of. The charges of racketeering, it looks like Kilpatrick put up a lemonade stand and ripped off lunch money compared to what's going on here today. And I'll tell you, that's what Detroit sees. And it's completely, completely divided by race lines. It's
are you sure you're not
right
giving us?
A,
are you sure you're not being? How should I say? A race specific, and you feel that you feel the need to defend the black leadership?
No. There was no defending Kilpatrick. There was no defending him. He had no politics, and he wouldn't listen to anyone. And we were watching him go down. And I couldn't figure out all the time that I was watching this, what has he done to really infuriate the power structure? Because in our vision, he gave away everything. He tried to get us to give away our schools, and he put a charter school ballot initiative on the ballot and supported charter schools. And Detroit voted it down 3-1. But immediately following that, he was in with the privatizers. There's no two ways about that. But the irony is that none of the bribers went to jail. None of the people who paid him went to jail. Only he and a few cronies have gone to jail. And not one white person has gone to jail around the Kilpatrick corruption charges. And there was a lot of white people involved, particularly the one who's going to be our mayor. So it is completely racialized, and I found also that Kilpatrick was indefensible, and he wasn't very much defended while he was going through all this, because he didn't do anything for the people. But he did everything for the corporations, and that's why we were baffled at the corporations going after him. But then it turns out that this was the underplay for the overlay, as we say here, was that the city was going to be taken over and there was going to be a consent agreement which would remove the power of the city council to do anything. And only then can huge multimillionaires come in with plans and take them and just implement them without having to go through a city council or anyone else. You don't have to get any development plans approved here. So they're displacing thousands of poor people to build a stadium, which Mike Ilitch gets to get, which would never be approved by voters or never have been approved by a city council or a city with a charter in place. That would have never been approved, to basically remove our neighborhoods and replace them with bond-funded stadia. He gets a new stadium. The other one is not paid for. He owes millions of dollars in taxes. You would never be able to get another project if you owed money to the city. But there are no rules in place to prohibit Mike Ilitch from doing that. So he's going to get a new stadium, and it's displacing thousands of poor people that live in those apartment buildings that Dan Gilbert came and purchased. Now comes Gilbert asking for bond money. He just got it approved in the Senate this week. He gets it's a Senate bill that allows public money to be used for private redevelopment. This could only be done if there was no government in place. This is what it looks like when philanthropists are in charge of your city. This is what Kellogg and Skillman and Broad and all of them do when they get to be in charge of your city.
How was Detroit different under Coleman Young?
Well, Coleman Young instituted the residency requirement, which meant that you live here, you work here, you work here, you live here. And there were appointees under the mayor that were, you know, they had to ride the buses, they had to go and stay in the shelters, they had to be on the ground. There was what was called mini city halls, so that there were outposts of the mayor's office in all the neighborhoods, so people could bring their problems to those places and get them resolved. And there was a great sense of ownership of the city of Detroit under Coleman Young. There was a great sense of pride and ownership. That was, and white people left. White people left in droves when Coleman Young was elected. They were leaving anyway, but they really, really left, and that created a tremendous divestment. But it also created a black city with a black power structure, even though it never had economic power because of the powerful structures of the auto industry and the banks here. But Coleman Young always said that the white left was angry at him because he didn't make it the People's Republic of Detroit. But that was not possible to do in the reality that we live in. We still live in a capitalist country with a city that was being starved out by the feds and by the state government. But for the most part, Detroit was thriving under the leadership of Coleman Young, probably for the first two administrations. So he was the longest-serving mayor in our history. He served for 20 years, and following him came Archer, and Archer brought in the casinos that were not black-owned, and that created a tremendous amount of resentment, and other giveaways as well. Lots of land giveaways under the Archer administration. So then Archer faced a recall in his second term, and he didn't run after the second term. Following Archer came Kilpatrick. So that's where that brings us to two terms of Kilpatrick, and then the scandal and the complete distraction during the Obama presidency.
And then we got Bing.
But Bing was brought in with 8% of the vote. 8% of Detroit went to the polls during the Bing. Everybody was so disgusted. And we had 6 elections in 2 years because of the state was just completely destabilizing Detroit under the Granholm and then the Snyder administration. Granholm was a Democratic governor who probably did as much damage to Detroit as any governor ever in our history.
You know, I called the office of a congressman I thought would have been enthusiastic to talk about this situation. This is John Conyers.
Uh-huh.
What response have you gotten from the federal level? Have you seen it materialize?
Conyers called for an investigation of all of this. Conyers, now remember too, and I have to say, John Conyers has been the congressman my whole life.
He has been
and
there
I'm
for
56
a long time.
Years old. So Conyers has been around here for a long time, and he's never, ever, ever wavered, never wavered on doing the right thing with regard to Detroit, never wavered. But right now, I think that there's so many forces, and he got redistricted, too. He ended up in a wildly, you know, mixed district that he'd still won in. But he's probably 85 or 86 years old, and he's, I would say, probably quite overwhelmed by this fight. He'd asked for Eric Holder to come in and investigate, and we were ignored. The same forces that were
Eric Holder of the Justice Department,
right.
U.S. Attorney General.
Right, we've been ignored. Yeah. In fact, the attorney general came in here and met with Kevin Orr, the emergency manager. So if your house gets broken into and the thief takes over and then answers the door when you come to visit, do you just meet with him? That's who you meet with? Just who's ever in charge? Like it's just incredible.
I like your metaphors, you know. But look, in this short time that you've been talking, I'm going to tell you seriously, what you're giving us, what you're talking about now and the way you are laying it out, this side of the story about Detroit, I mean, we got this information as part of Tom Segrew's presentation back in August, but from this perspective at the community, I mean, you are grassroots, you know what's happening and how people are interpreting their reality in Detroit. And it is, I've read story after story after story. I haven't seen it. It is not there. The real issues, the racial bifurcation of Detroit.
Absolutely. The
possibilities that loomed for a city where blacks who had waited it out and who had gone to Detroit with bright hopes for a better future and so forth, and whose children were in place to assume their, you know, to basically own the town. That's shot to heck. And now you have the city itself in a position now to lead the way as a kind of example. I'm calling it a domino effect of systematic, forcible emptying and a reinvention of the city according to the visions of people who think it ought to be, quote, different, unquote. And what is looming on the horizon is, this is just my theory, I have no scientific proof of it, if it goes that way for Detroit, soon we will hear it going the same way in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., in Oakland, California. You know, these are the cities that are teetering on the brink, and they are large, they have very large African-American and Latino populations.
Let me interrupt you here for a minute. Every city in Michigan, every single black city in Michigan is under an emergency manager. That's Detroit, Flint, Highland Park, Muskegon Heights, Benton Harbor. Benton Harbor was the first to go. Every one of these cities that has black leadership has been placed under emergency manager. The NAACP filed a lawsuit against the state because other cities that are white who are in worse financial shape were not put under emergency managers. To date, we have no results. So the cities that you name are possibilities for going, but most likely Detroit has a unique history. If the best way we could compare it is probably Haiti and Toussaint. And that's the reason that Haiti has been penalized as it has in her entire history is because they rose up. Detroit elected Coleman Young, who white people hated because he was absolutely brilliant and absolutely fearless and absolutely beloved by the people. Detroit has never, ever, ever had a mayor like that. And that's the reason that we have not been forgiven. When there's mayors like Kilpatrick or mayors like Bing, they don't mind. But when you have a mayor who has the complete respect and love of the people and is brilliant and knows what to do and knows how to make the cuts and knows how to make people sacrifice and stand with people who are sacrificing, not living in a different way, that's going to create a backlash like we're seeing here. My contention is it's Coleman Young and the city that we have been that is the reason that we're being taken over. And all these people's pensions are about to be stolen, and they can point the finger at Kilpatrick, who's haplessly sitting in prison, as if he's the reason that Jones Day gets to absorb all these people's pensions that they have worked for firefighters, Detroit firefighters and police officers and city workers who have lived and worked their whole lives here and worked for the pensions that were promised to them are about to be taken by a bank who did nothing to earn them. And it's entirely because this has been a working class, successful black city.
I am imagining, Elena, that there would have been by now in Detroit assembled a really tough group, fierce group of people who understand what is about to happen in Detroit and what, by virtue of success in Detroit, would now be exported to other cities.
Right.
And we will see mass, this is like a mass takeover.
Right.
When I refer to Detroit, I'm also referring to, you know, the outlying areas as well. But the heart of the city is the pulse that also beats in the, you know, in the neighboring towns and villages and cities
right.
of Detroit. So I'm imagining that this would have been a cause for great alarm in the African-American community, especially the African-American professional and political community.
It is.
That they would have fashioned something, a flank of resistance, and said, no, we are here. We have to defend. This is like, you know, we have to make a stand here. And we have to do something. Call a serious emergency and say we have to pay attention to this. We've got to save Detroit.
Well, the emergency manager configuration is very powerful, and people are really afraid. So the quote-unquote elections coming up have really divided people because the candidate who is actually really an emergency manager who is about to be elected as mayor has the ability to buy off so much of the leadership. So the NAACP and many, many of the organizations, we joke about the Black Panther Party. There's a small, you know, like a imitating Black Panther Party here that actually is supporting Duggan, the white candidate, who's actually really going to be the emergency manager, who's been in conversations with the emergency manager for the last 2 years. And that's going to be our mayor. So the money was spread around so broadly that there's a great deal of who should be in the fight, not in the fight. So it's not as clear as that. It's very complex.
Wow. If you don't mind taking a couple of calls, Elena.
Not at all.
All right. We'll open up the phone lines. You can talk with Elena Herrada at 888-874-4888. I should let you know, listeners, that this is not the first time you'll be talking to Elena. She'll be back quite regularly because this is a story that has to be told, and you're not going to hear it, certainly not from this vantage point, if you pick up a newspaper or a magazine to read about Detroit. You will hear only about the fact that the city is in a state of fiscal disarray. It practically has no future except if it is saved from itself by, you know, declaring the city bankrupt. And that, of course, immediately wipes out many people's pensions and savings.
16 small cents businesses. On the dollar is what they're offering to the retirees. 16 cents on the dollar. The Jones Day, who did nothing to earn our money, is able to take away from us if the bankruptcy judge allows this. 16 cents on the dollar that people worked. And I'm talking about Detroit cops and firefighters. You can't even imagine what their lives were like.
Well, you know, you begin to ask the question, the United States is busy exporting all this military aid and economic development aid and humanitarian aid and so forth. Here is a real bona fide state of emergency in a major city of the United States. What have you heard from, except for, you know, the feeble response you got or non-response from the Justice Department, what have you heard from the president?
The president came brought in $300 million that was already ours. And
he gave you the money that was
It was
yours.
Already ours. It was already our money. It was federal money that was about to be sent back because Bing held off on sending. They weren't using the federal money that was ours here because that was part of the lead up to the takeover. Is not spending money that we have. So the governor was directing the mayor. The governor directed the mayor not to accept the union concessions. There would have been,
and that's all you heard from Obama. $300 million. When you're talking about $18 billion.
Yep, and everybody was so excited that we got our own money, our $300 million. Right.
I don't want to laugh. It's the way you're saying it. I don't want. Believe me, I don't. It's something to cry over.
I know, with all due respect, and I'm not in any way trying to malign Obama, because if anything, what we are facing here has shown me and shown Detroit that we understand now that a president simply cannot do anything. It's not that the president doesn't have the will. The president absolutely has no ability to do anything. Corporations are running everything.
Hello. Mike from D.C., you're on the air with Elena Herrada.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hello there.
Good afternoon.
Hi. I just wanted to basically echo, like, what Detroit is going through. I grew up in Baltimore, and in the 60s and 70s, we had a mayor named Schaefer, and Schaefer was, like, beloved by the people of Baltimore because he was, like, really neighborhood-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this investment in the public infrastructure in Baltimore so that we had rec centers and we had, like, all of these different programs. But what I see in Detroit is, like, mirroring what is going on across the nation, and that's basically the corporate, like, takeover of mm-hmm. everything. And when you have, like, these people that are running these corporations and these governments are sociopaths. They have no connection mm-hmm. to anything but
mm-hmm.
money,
mm-hmm.
right? You know what I mean?
Right.
Money is their god,
right.
And I'm talking across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're talking about religion, we're talking about education. All of these systems are being run by sociopaths.
Mm-hmm.
Until we get people who actually care about other people running these systems and these institutions, what we are doing is futile. You can't win.
Mike, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
Based on what you've heard today, have you heard this anywhere about what's going on in Detroit?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've been kind of like following Kwame Kilpatrick's descent.
Right.
Because I'm like first generation hip hop. I helped
mm-hmm.
form
mm-hmm.
hip hop. So when he ascended to the mayorship in Detroit, there were other people that I went to school with, like Sandy McDonald. I don't know if you know of Sandy McDonald. He was a really prominent business person in Detroit. And also, I know of Dave Bing. But Detroit, to me, and Baltimore are a lot alike, because Detroit had the auto industry, which
mm-hmm.
basically, you know, everybody was affiliated with it.
Right.
Baltimore had the steel industry, which
mm-hmm.
everybody was affiliated with Bethlehem Steel.
Mm-hmm.
And when the corporations, when they came in and looted Bethlehem Steel and basically offshored everything, that's when Baltimore basically declined.
Mm-hmm.
And they sold it off to the highest bidder.
But they did build a really nice business development at the port.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the harbor is lovely. if you were to drive in from out of town, and they funded two brand new stadiums adjacent to the harbor.
Of course, it's purdy, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely, using public money,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
we got no benefit.
I mean,
it's a race to the bottom
mm-hmm.
is what we're experiencing. And if people
they're just making our cities playgrounds.
Yeah, it absolutely is. They're hollowing out what used to be America. They're hollowing it out so that the middle class will be gone. There will be only wealthy people, and there will be the lower class. That will be it.
No, there won't be the lower class. They will have to go and commute
to serve them, walk the dogs, take care of the cats, cook the meals, and do the laundry.
So, Ms. Leeds, can I ask you a question? Yes.
Sure.
At some point, and can you do this for me? Can you have a show about the most friendly places for African Americans outside of the U.S.?
Okay. That would be fun.
Yeah, I'm thinking like Cuba. I don't even speak Spanish.
Everybody's saying this here, but you know what? Everybody's saying this here. We've been in Detroit here, and I'll say we, as a Mexican-American, let me just throw in here. We've been here. We built this city. This is our city, and we don't have another home. We can't go back to anywhere. These forces that are taken do not belong here. This is not theirs. Why should we go? Why should we go? There's no reason. And then we go into someplace else and displace somebody else. We might as well stay home.
And the indigenous population that was in Detroit before all of us got here said the same thing.
Thank you so much, Mike. I'm so glad you called. Great to get a call from D.C. today. Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. Jay from New York, you're on the air with Elena Herrada.
Yes, good afternoon to you, Eutrice, and your guests.
Thank you.
I feel that this is the test case of what's to come for all major cities within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
If they can get away with what's going on in Detroit, because based on some of the reports that I've seen, a lot of this stuff is just totally illegal. From there, it'll be Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and then someplace else, and someplace else. And within, 4 to 6 years, it'll be here in New York. But it's basically coming. The thing that I would like to see is, how do people like yourself and Eutrice and myself come together and fight back against the absolute greed that goes on in this country? At some point in time, we have to figure out how we can wake up the American people. And when I say American people, I don't put black people, Latinos, and others in that. I put these delusional white people in it, because they're the ones that are backing these Neanderthals in the Congress and the Senate that go about doing these things when, the sad thing is, it's against their best interest.
But Jay, we have to
figure out how we can do this.
I would have to say, Jay, that it is no longer the case. I mean, we just heard, I have not discussed this with Elena Herrada, my opinion about Obama, and she said exactly the same thing I've been saying here. You can't, the man is controlled. You have leadership out there. So the idea is first to do the education. You have to educate people, and this is one of the ways to do it, educate people. But it is amazing to me that the problem is so huge, so clearly visible, screaming for attention and screaming for solutions, and the very people who are in a position to do something do nothing. I mean, when you said that the president gave you 300 of your own million, mm-hmm. of your own money back, and people are supposed to be grateful about that, when Detroit is sinking under $18 billion in debt, incurring expenses at the rate of $1 million a day to just have bare bones operations. And this is the response of the president. The president, to me, a president who sees the value here would have convened all kinds of people, economists, whatever it is. How do we restore Detroit? How do we save Detroit? How do we save other cities like Detroit? This conversation is not being had.
Their narrative on saving it is give it to the banks.
Yeah, but the thing which both of y'all are missing is that, I mean, I'm sad to say it, but the fact is that doesn't have anything at all to do with black people. That's white people who control those institutions that benefit from these
things.
No, but
you have to be very clear.
How do black people benefit from these institutions?
No, black folks are doing it. You have to be really serious about it. Black folks are doing it. It's not just white folks. They're all siding with money, and they're all deciding that it is a far easier road to walk if they encounter no resistance. They don't want to be in this. They don't want to respond. It is too hard, and it's so much easier to go with the winning side. Nobody wants to take on a tough
road.
The
group of us that are fighting this are being completely marginalized. Because there's so many the money that's going around, you have to imagine if you fleeced everybody and had all this money, there's millions of dollars. And they said that Jones Day had $6 million just to pay off grassroots people and candidates to be able to buy the city council election. $6 million was put aside for Detroit city council elections. $6 million in local elections, which are district. There are district elections. That's an incredible amount of money to pour on such a poor city. And then you know that it's very, very easy to buy off poor people. I look at this every day. I think about this every day. I live, breathe, and drink it. And all I'm looking at is we can't get people to fight this. And it's very much the same way as asking people to boycott Walmart. When you don't have any money and it's right there and that's the only place where you can go to get the things that you need and everything is so cheap, you're not going to be thinking about why it's so cheap. You're not going to be thinking about you're going to be thinking about surviving. That's why they can't get any boycott on Walmart. You're never going to get Detroit to boycott Walmart because people are poor. They're really, really desperate. And if somebody's dangling $50 in front of you to go on the bus and say, yeah, vote for Mike Duggan, there you have absolutely no reason not to do it. So there's this whole, this is a colonial takeover, and the poverty that's so deeply entrenched here is being used to be able to enrich and impoverish further.
Thank you, Jay, for your question. Elena,
have a good day.
Thank you. Elena, we've come close to the end of the program today, but just this opening, this casual conversation that we're having is already, I hope, boggling people's minds. Because, again, the narrative that you have laid out is not the narrative that people are hearing across the country.
I really, really hope that people will listen closely and pay attention. The thing that makes us, that silences us more than anything, is the fact that this is a black city. Nothing silences us from the national master narrative more than that. And the second thing is the impression that's been given of us deserving this. Of us doing this to ourselves here, of us we couldn't begin to dream of corruption the way it's being brought to us now. We couldn't ever have begun to conceive of such corruption. We were so not ready for Jones Day. We were so not ready for Snyder to impose an emergency manager on the cities and the schools. We were never prepared for somebody to come in here, close our schools, take our money, and steal pensions from the retirees. They attacked our old people. They attacked our children. And there's a margin of a standing in between, just not even knowing where to begin. You can't get people to fight against power like that. They're used to power being in charge, and they're not used to power being so completely morally bankrupt. People are not prepared to take on that battle.
So we will get back with you real soon. I'm going to call you after the program and see when the soonest you can be back to continue this conversation, because I could see so many people want to join into it. But thank you so much, Elena. It was a joy talking with you today. And
thank you so much.
Hasta luego.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. So thank you so much. I hope this was, it was a casual conversation, but you listened to the depth of it, and you already see, my God, are these things really happening? Is this really what the story of Detroit is? Yes, it is. And make it clear to yourselves that Detroit is the domino that will kill over and take out other cities as well with the same formula. It's a testing ground for massive urban removal. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. You want to stay tuned and come back here tomorrow for more lead stories. Thanks so much.